Hi, I'm Nancy Rowe, and I'm joined with Kim Brown for Liver Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights. We have the incredible pleasure of having our good friend Mauro Ranella, who is an internationally known NAFLD MASLD expert. You can see that I am not. I already got us off on the wrong terminology. She is a professor of medicine and the director of the Metabolic Liver Program, as well as the director of clinical trials at University of Chicago. Her reach in this field has been, huge. She's part of the practice guidance document and an international lecture so that we all are following Maru's advice when it comes to how to manage our patients with metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. So thank you, Maru, for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm excited to talk about unfiltered stuff related to liver disease.
Yeah, with no filtering, that probably
No
takes out all
filter.
the good sediment and the antioxidants. So we're
Exactly.
unfiltered here.
Yes.
Well, I think that maybe we can talk a little bit about the fact that we have one FDA-approved agent, and it's probably not a perfect one-size-fits-all. So one of the biggest limitations is its use in cirrhosis, which it's not yet approved for. And we have some pretty exciting data looking at some of the pipeline. And the New England Journal had a great publication on some of the GLP-1. So maybe we'll just start an open-ended lob. What is your opinion for use of this class of medicines, GLP-1s? And maybe I can ask, are you using it, not necessarily off-label, because we definitely can use it in some of our patients with metabolic liver disease as they have indications for these agents, but maybe some of your enthusiasm and what you think this trial is going to, do to the future.
So I think GLP-1s in general have become just almost, I think in my clinic, probably 60% of my patients are already on a GLP-1 by the time they walk in the door. So it's very commonly used. Of course, they're approved for, obesity, diabetes. Tirzepatide's approved for obstructive sleep apnea. They're beneficial in heart failure. They have long-term cardiovascular and cardiorenal benefits. So we know that those drugs are very effective as a class, I would say, but specifically semaglutide, in that we're going to talk about right now. So basically, we know they're beneficial, and most of the patients we see with MASLD are going to have a lot of these diseases. So yes, I do often start these medications in people who have indications for them. As far as their effect on MASLD itself, I think the primary effect is through weight loss. However, interestingly, in the SEMA trial, in the ESSENCE trial, the weight loss was only about 10%. So it's actually a lot less than you would see in a non-diabetic population, like in an obesity trial. So maybe there is a component of it that's not, but what we did see is very substantial resolution of steatohepatitis, which was one of the endpoints. And actually, I would say, a bit surprisingly, an improvement in fibrosis. And the reason why I say that is because I think most of its action is through weight loss. I think part of the reason why you start to see an improvement in fibrosis out to 72 weeks, because this is a long trial, is partly because it takes time to lose weight, I mean to for fibrosis to go down in response to weight loss, like you might see with bariatric surgery, for example. But there may be a little bit of a non-weight loss dependent effect too.
Yeah. Mauro, I similar to you, I think every patient who comes into my clinic now is on one of these medications for one reason or another. But I do see a population of patients that actually don't lose weight. So your comment that you think the action is primarily through weight loss, do you think patients who are unable to lose weight benefit from these in terms of their liver disease?
Probably not a lot. I'm going to say there are some diseases where there are definitely GLP-1, there are weight loss independent effects of GLPs, like, for example, diabetes. So you start to see improvements in A1C before weight goes down at all. And in fact, if you look at some of the oral GLP-1 preps, they don't have a lot of weight loss, but they still improve the diabetes. So there are some instances where that's true. I don't think it's particularly true in MASH. And I would say certainly, unless you're getting a benefit for another reason, there would be no reason to use it for MASH, A, it's not FDA approved for that. Hopefully it will be in the next year or so, but we do have an FDA approved medication already. And so that would be an example where you would want to consider using a drug that's approved for the disease already, so which would be resmetirom. So that would be sort of the scenario that I would definitely use that.
So I have patients that kind of come in, they're found to have more advanced fibrosis, not cirrhosis, and the expectation is it's MASH. And the first thing I do is I look at their other medications, and if they're not on a GLP-1 for their diabetes, or if they have an indication, then I encourage them to, you know, get that either through endocrinology or we prescribe it. But they still also have indications for resmetirom. And the resmetirom trial didn't exclude people on stable GLP-1s. I've not been brave enough to start both at the same time as they have GI side effects, but do you think it's like, how much time would you give someone who starts a GLP before you would add resmetirom? I know this is not evidence-based. This is us asking your opinion.
Yeah, for sure.
It's evidence-based.
So I would say minimum 3 months, but usually 6 months. So you actually continue to see weight loss from GLPs out to a year. But I would say 6 months is certainly adequate as far as a trial. And I don't start them both at the same time either, because you want to know which drug it is causing a side effect if there is one. So I definitely will stagger them. And depending on what the dominant, you know, risk factor is, I would either start with resmetirom or start with the GLP, just depending on the individual patient.
That personalized approach certainly makes a lot of sense.
So I'd be interested in your opinion. You know, there's a lot of phase 2 trials with not just the GLPs, but the GLPs in combination with other things. And all showing, you know, promising benefits, I think, in terms of certainly MASH resolution, some with fibrosis regression. Right. Do you think at any point, I mean, how do you think this is going to play out in the future when we have a number of medications that seem to fall in the same class of drugs for use? How, you know, what do you think is going to happen in the future?
Well, just to kind of summarize in case people aren't totally aware of what's going on in this space. So we have mostly for the GLP combinations, like the GLP, glucagon, GLP, GIP, or the triple combination, which is retatrutide, we don't have phase 3 data. And that's important because we can't really assess fibrosis response in small numbers with a shorter trial. So I think there's a big caveat. The papers that have been published that are in the 2B realm, so that would be survodutide, which is going to be a GLP glucagon receptor agonist. That was published in the New England Journal like 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, maybe. And then there's also tirzepatide, which is GLP-GIP, also published in the New England Journal. Neither of those showed an improvement in fibrosis on intention to treat. Maybe it's because of the duration or the size of the trial, but on intention to treat, neither of those met, you know, were statistically significant for fibrosis reduction, which is kind of what we saw with semaglutide also in the phase 2B. That's why I think some of us were we were very excited about it, but we were a little surprised that fibrosis was hit, you know, by, you know, but I think it may have to do a little bit with the duration of the treatment. I think eventually all of these will cause a reduction in fibrosis. What you do see difference wise in across the different, either the GLP or the GLP combination drugs, is going to be the extent of weight loss. Like, for example, with tirzepatide or with retatrutide, you're going to see very dramatic or very significant weight loss. Tirzepatide less so than retatrutide. So I think that needs to get played out, and we need to see what happens in the phase 3 of tirzepatide or retatrutide, basically.
I was just going to ask, you know, I'd be interested in your thoughts, since these are being used currently, you know, even off-label for this purpose. The observation, particularly in patients with more advanced disease, where, you know, as a hepatologist, I want those patients to have the best response because they have the most fibrosis, but yet we see such You know, in some cases, I feel these patients become malnourished. They lose a lot of muscle mass. And in our patient population with more advanced liver disease, I've actually asked them to stop the GLPs with that sort of risk-benefit ratio. But is this something you observed in the patient population? And do you think this is something that may, you know, may challenge us in patient populations with more advanced disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as you're alluding to, you know, when you have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, you are more likely to have sarcopenia even at baseline, right? Of course, that's part of the disease process. So weight loss in general is associated with a 25% loss of muscle for every, I guess, for the body weight that you lose, a quarter of it is muscle. That's weight loss of any kind. So bariatric surgery, diet and exercise, unless you're doing a lot of, you know, strength training, you're going to lose muscle along with that. So I think part of, or the majority of what you'll see with the GLPs is not specifically related to GLPs. It's specifically related to weight loss. And there are some interesting studies that are looking at a combination of GLP with certain agonists like myosin and other agonists that will sort of counter and actually increase lean muscle mass. But right now we don't, you know, we don't really have access to that. So I would say I'm careful about using it in people that are advanced liver disease. But I do think you can still use it in cirrhosis. With the benefit, I think, is much more marginal. In cirrhosis, I think you still might see a cardiovascular benefit, but there are, even though we haven't seen any data that it works in cirrhosis, like histologically, there are data showing that there may be a reduction in liver-related events and mortality. So I think I'm still a little bit on the fence about it, but I still give it to people with cirrhosis. I just monitor them.
Yeah, and I think it's a little reassuring that there is data with diabetes and obesity and cirrhosis. So I think that we know a little about safety with these agents,
right,
even if we don't have full understanding of efficacy in patients with more advanced disease. But just like Kim, I have patients that are on these agents and they'll come in and they'll be like, oh, I haven't been hungry for 2 days. I haven't eaten anything. And then we have to talk about, you know, the importance of their nutrition. It's just, you know, some people have pretty profound anorexia or, I don't know, and, you know, just the lack of desire to eat and, you know, drink alcohol, which, you know, maybe it's going to help us as our met ALD.
It does. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't, you know, as we all tell our cirrhotic patients, you know, you never want to be fasting for more than, you know, 6 to 8 hours. You always want to have a bedtime snack, et cetera. So this would certainly go in the face of that. So again, it's a question of competing mortality. And if you have somebody with advanced cirrhosis, I mean, they're going to more likely die of their liver disease than they are of other things. So you can, you know, you can, I guess in a case-by-case basis, if somebody has significant obesity, it's an impediment to transplant or whatever. I guess you really have to just individualize it to the individual patient's needs. But no, I agree. You can't have people not eating for 2 days, obviously, if they have cirrhosis. That would be bad.
Well, one of the other classes of medicines that we're looking forward to are some of the FGF21s or these integrins, I think is that how you would describe them? And they have GI side effects, but I at least thought that they would have more anti-fibrotic effects. I think some early data, you know, seemed to have some, you know, near fantastical non-invasive measures of fibrosis that made us pretty enthusiastic. But there was a recent study that maybe took a little of the edge off. Is that making you think that the class may not have the same impact as what we had hoped?
No, definitely not. So are you referring to the Symmetry, this efruxifermin New England Journal paper? Okay, yeah. So I'll explain that one in a second. But the generally speaking, I think the FGF2, so the incretins are the GLP-1s, GIPs, and all those. But these would be the FGF21s. There are several that are under development right now, and they, I think, are extremely promising. I will say, I think that what we have data on so far, which is just phase 2B, they're the biggest fibrosis differences of any class we've seen. So I do think that they are potentially going to be a very important tool in the future. We won't have access to those provided they're approved, you know, well into probably 2029. But just to touch a little bit on the Symmetry trial. So that was the efruxifermin study that looked at the primary endpoint for that trial was 36 weeks. And these are people with cirrhosis. Okay. So if you think about it, if you have somebody with cirrhosis, say they have hepatitis C, you eradicate their hepatitis C, in 36 weeks, you're not going to see an improvement in fibrosis, right? In fact, you're not going to see fibrosis improvement at a year either, probably, if you eradicate the virus. And so I think that we need to be, I think we, as a society, not society ASLD, but as a, like, as a group of physicians, we need to stop talking about modest this effect on fibrosis, because the truth is, we don't have drugs that improve fibrosis, right? And any liver disease. And so it's pretty cool that we're seeing improvements in fibrosis histologically at all. Histology may not be the way to measure, right? But in any case, that being said, so 36 weeks cirrhosis. So I would have never expected. The reason why that endpoint was so short, I'm just going to waver a guess that it was my very good friend, Steve Harrison, who basically said, oh, this is a great class of drugs. This is incredibly powerful. I bet you we can show a difference in 36 weeks. Okay. Well, that's great, because he was the eternal optimist, right? But I would have argued that there's no way you're going to show a difference in 36 weeks. And so the secondary, or the secondary part of the trial, was to take that drug out to 96 weeks, which is more sensible of an endpoint for cirrhosis, right? And lo and behold, there was a difference. And it's not reported as as significant per se in the paper, because it wasn't a pre-specified part of the pre-specified analysis of that trial. So, and New England is very, rightfully so, very strict about that. But it was a difference. And if you look at the non-cirrhosis studies, I really believe they're going to work. I really do. So I think that when we see the phase three results of efruxifermin or pegozafermin, I think I would be surprised if we didn't see an improvement in fibrosis, honestly. And I would be surprised if they weren't bigger differences in fibrosis. But, you know, we'll see. We don't know, right, until it's not able to the fat lady sings, I suppose. And that would be the phase three trial. I don't know. But those are all ongoing. Those studies are all ongoing. So hopefully we'll see. Well, I was excited by it. I just think that we were not able to say, hey, look at the results. This is cirrhosis. Like, nobody's ever shown an improvement in cirrhosis, right? Because it wasn't pre-specified, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I do think it's still super exciting.
I don't know about you and Kim, but I think sometimes even just lack of progression is a really important metric.
Yeah.
And some of our patients, especially our younger patients, that I have patients that I knew biopsy proven steatosis with inflammation, minimal fibrosis, and in my practice lifetime, now granted I am old, but I have seen them progressed decompensated cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't take, well, I guess maybe it does take 30 years. I've been practicing for a while. But, you know, in some of these patients, they don't follow the slowly progressive disease course. And I think if you can put the brakes on something, that shouldn't be underestimated.
No, you're right. But the problem is, you know, we're very much focused on, you know, what the FDA will approve, right? Progression to cirrhosis is an acceptable endpoint, like outcome, right? So if you can show that you prevent progression to cirrhosis, then that's great. That's an FDA approvable outcome. The reverse is not necessarily true, though, for cirrhosis. So, and stability of disease is also not going to be enough, probably not either. So, but you're right. I mean, if you prevent somebody from developing cirrhosis, you know, I mean, that should work. That should get you approval. But if you stay at a lower stage, it's not going to help you, unfortunately. But you're right. I agree. You're helping that person if you can prevent that.
And I think now we see with other medications, the FDA is requiring liver-related outcomes, you know, transplantation and death. And you know, those trials would have to be going on for years, you know, to get to those endpoints. So it makes it very challenging.
I mean, it's really hard. It's really, really challenging because, you know, as Nancy said, it's a slow, generally, other than there's a group of people who progress rapidly, generally, it's fairly slow moving. And if you're looking for liver-related outcomes, you're going to have to choose people that are really, really advanced. And then you may not see an improvement. You may not be able to improve them anymore, right? So you're sort of stuck in this catch-22 where you need people to be sick enough to have outcomes or close enough to an outcome to be able to show a difference, but not so sick that they're not going to respond to the intervention anymore. So I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to, you know, move forward with non-invasive assessment. So non-invasive surrogates, like biopsy is a surrogate for an outcome, which is liver-related outcomes. NITs, hopefully we're getting closer and closer, hopefully, to be able to say, you know what, a 0.5 drop, you know, in ELF, or, you know, a 20% drop in liver stiffness by MRE, or, you know, pick your 30% reduction in VCTE stiffness. That's going to give you improved outcomes down the road. So approve us as a surrogate, and then we take it to outcomes following long term. I would love to see that happen. I think it will happen. I think it will happen. I think we're getting more and more evidence to support that. So we'll see.
So, getting back to the FGF21 class, do you think the effects that we're seeing potentially in MASH, the fibrosis regression, is more a direct antifibrotic effect or more an effect on glucose lipid metabolism? And I ask this because will these drugs, you know, be beneficial in our patients with PBC or PSC or, you know, other progressive liver diseases?
Yeah, so I do think that they are directly antifibrotic. They primarily are going to reduce inflammation, and they are going to alter lipid signaling. They do, many of them, improve insulin resistance, but not to a massive degree. But it's really, I think, direct effects on stellate cells, or indirect through reducing inflammation or inflammatory drive. So that's why I think you see much bigger, at least. Of course, you can't compare trial to trial, but the difference between drug and placebo is more sizable. It's in like the 20-30 realm as opposed to the 12-14 realm. So I think you potentially could use it. Now, the thing with FGF21s is that, you know, they're endogenous. It's an endogenous hormone that's released when in stress, right? So if you are, it's drinking alcohol, for example, or you have diabetes or what other metabolic stress, that gets released. It's just very short acting. So these are going to try to recapitulate those things in a long acting form. So I don't know if it would help other forms of liver disease. It might. I mean, it might if there's a lot of inflammation, I would say.
Yeah.
I also heard there's a rumor that they decrease alcohol intake.
They do. They do. Yeah. Although I'm going to say, so the animal data, there's animal data on that. But the doses you would have to give for a human are much higher than what we're giving in clinical trials. Nevertheless, it's being looked at. And, you know, I think we'll have some answers to that, but I don't think it's as strong as, say, the GLP-1 effects on reduction in alcohol intake, because there's also human data that shows that too. And in FGF21s, at least as of, you know, last time I looked fairly recently, I don't think there's any human data showing that decisively, but.
Yeah, I do. You know, it's interesting you see that in your patient population who report to you a less desire for alcohol. It'll be interesting to look at the GLPs in patients maybe with MET ALD.
Yeah.
You know, where they're going to potentially have positive effects on both sides of the equation.
Yeah, I think one of the cool things that came out of the nomenclature change is that many are looking at sort of steatotic liver disease is just a one big spectrum, and there's a lot more excitement and activity in the sort of intersection between metabolic liver disease and alcohol, and whether it's strictly MET ALD or even that's translating into excitement in alcohol. So there are trials that are looking at, I think Novo Nordisk, I think, has a combination trial in people with alcohol-related liver disease that also have metabolic risk factors. So I think it's opened up an exciting area of research. So I mean, so I'm very hopeful. I somehow really feel like the FGF21s, though, because I do believe they're really antifibrotic. They will be potentially in the future used in a almost like an induction sort of way, like treat for a period of time, and then maybe you hold. And the reason why I say that is because some of the older, or specifically one of them called pegbelfermin, which no longer is being developed, you develop tachyphylaxis to it. And there's no obvious evidence of that in the ones that are being studied right now, but that's certainly a potential concern. So who knows? But I think they're very promising, at least for reduction in fibrosis. So, well, and MASH resolution too, actually, and fat reduction. Really good.
I mean, it cannot be a bad thing to have multiple drug classes that can be used for these patients. And we've only touched on three. There are there are several others that we have not covered.
There are. Did you want me to cover?
No.
Another day.
We'll borrow you another day. I mean, we're
going to talk
about anything you want.
Oh, gosh. So if you 10 years into the future, is this going to be something where 100% of our patients have opportunity for treatment, or are we still going to be working on this?
10 years. I think that we'll have a treatment for everybody for the most part. I think that decompensated cirrhosis is not going to be something that we've tackled at that time. We have yet to see any drug really convincingly work in decompensated cirrhosis in this space, or really any space other than beta blockers and things like that. So I think we have a lot of work to do so far with that. But I think for the standard, the garden variety MASH, if that exists, because there's so many, it's so heterogeneous, I think we'll have a lot of GLPs. We'll have probably pan PPARs available. We'll have FGF21s available, I'm pretty sure. We may have denifanstat, which is a FASN inhibitor, available. So I think we'll have tools in the toolbox, which is better than what I had when I started my career in this, which would be zero. So,
yeah. Exercise and weight loss.
Yes. Well, yes, of course. No, I mean, medication-wise. Yes.
Okay. I know.
Of course. Exercise and weight loss is very important.
Yeah, exactly.
Foundational. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you, Mario, for joining us. This, we are always so excited to have someone that is so eloquent and such an expert in this field. And I'm sure that Kim and I both look forward to having you back on the Liver Lineup.
All right. Thank you. It's a lot of fun. Got to do it again.
Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.